Blog Talk Radio.
To Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show, coming to you from our studios in exciting El Paso, Texas, gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today is September 11th, the anniversary of when the planes hit the Twin Towers in New York City. When the first bombing took place, I was on the way there. I stopped to pick up my, get my glasses fixed, and it took them a little while, so we were one stop before the World Trade Center stopped when it was announced that nobody would be allowed off the subway. On 9/11, I was sitting in my office here in El Paso listening to his name was Paul Strelzin. He's no longer with us, I understand. He became a good friend. He's a radio talk show host. And he was talking to Congressman Reyes, I think, Sylvester Reyes, who used to be the congressperson here. And he announced that first the first plane hit, then the second plane hit. And then we got out the TV. Now, I usually went to the office at 4:30 in the morning because I was always dealing with the East Coast. There's a two-hour time difference. So I'd already been there for several hours when all this took place. But for my time spent in New York City, I had business in the World Trade Center quite often. Had we still lived there, I would have probably have been there because the company I was working for was looking to move its offices there. And I would have been highly annoyed had a plane come through my window. But there's still questions about the World Trade Center disaster. And one of our congresspeople says, some people did something. Well, yeah, 2,977 people died because some people did something. And that's just the ones they know about. And beneath the World Trade Center complex were tunnels and vaults and God knows what all. Well, we're going to go to our topic for tonight, which is strange happenings. Now, if there's one house in the world where ghosts are comfortably accommodated, I guess you could say, then it's surely the Eleventh Century Manor House at Sanford Dorcas in Dorset. Because of seven rooms on the premises, there are seven ghosts. Now, Colonel Francis Claridge bought that house, an industrial chemist who'd been researching a cure for cancer for more than 10 years. His work occupied much of his time, so he moved away from London to the seclusion of rural Dorset just before Christmas in 1966. He was able to be able to continue his research without too many distractions. Unfortunately, he wasn't to enjoy the peace and tranquility he'd been expecting. Because since he and his wife moved into the house, they were haunted by a gaggle of ghosts. Now, there's one artistically minded ghost who sits sometimes for hours on end in an empty room above the derelict gatehouse playing music from a harpsichord. The music is described as beautiful but sad. And the harpsichord is as ethereal as the ghost itself. One evening, a guest of the colonel's who thought the whole thing was a hoax, made up as a conversation piece, decided to unmask the culprit, crept into the tumble-down gatehouse in the dark. Creeping up the stone stairs, he paused outside the room and listened, and he could hear the music being played, and faintly he could hear a woman's voice humming softly to the harpsichord. So he threw open a door, jumped inside. The room was empty. No woman, no harpsichord. But the music, which was beyond any doubt being played right there in that room, became almost deafening. And then suddenly it stopped. In mid-note. And then there's the ghost who inhabits the middle bedroom of the house. This was first noticed one evening by Miss Claridge's sister, who was sleeping there during a holiday earlier in the year. Walking into her bedroom, she could smell strong, fragrant pipe smoke. Wondering who was there, she looked around and saw a cloud of smoke hovering above an armchair placed facing the window. Then she saw a long jet of smoke being blown from the chair. But when she looked, the chair was empty. Nobody else in the room, just her and the drifting clouds of smoke. Well, she was so surprised she didn't say a word about it until the following afternoon when Miss Claridge came downstairs and asked her sister how long she'd been smoking. And her sister denied she smoked, so the two went back up to the bedroom and they both noticed the unmistakable aroma of rich cigar-like tobacco. There was nobody except the two women in the house. Colonel Claridge had been staying in London overnight on business. And neither Miss Claridge nor her sister had been known to smoke. And another spirit is that of an old bent woman who has been seen on several instances walking slowly up the stairs from the main hallway. She's always heard muttering angrily to herself, leaning on a stout walking stick and pulling herself up by the banister. Usually when she reaches the landing, she glances back down the stairs, takes a deep sigh, and vanishes. Then there's the man ghost, who wears a fairly modern, light-colored lounge suit. He's appeared many times, generally when there are several people together in the house. Now, the first time he appeared to the Claridges and their guests was at their Christmas party. Several people noticed him walking among the guests, a sad, anxious expression on his face, as if he was looking for somebody special. He wouldn't realize he was a ghost till that evening when a London journalist was helping his wife look for her coat in the upstairs dressing room. Glancing around, they both saw the man peering in at him from the open window. Well, suddenly, realizing he'd been seen, he vanished, and they thinking he must have fallen, dashed to the window and looked down at the driveway, which is 20 feet below, but they didn't see anybody. Then there's a ghost of a beautiful, dark-haired young woman wearing a light blue cloak who can be glimpsed usually early in the morning, stealing cautiously across the courtyard to the derelict gatehouse. She reaches it, pauses, looks carefully around her, and then vanishes inside. Some think it's her spirit that can be heard playing a harpsichord and humming to herself. If so, she's quite talented. The music has been described as just simply beautiful. Of course, no haunted house would be complete without a poltergeist. And there's one of those as well. Its favorite ploy is to lock room doors from the inside, crumple cigarettes to pieces, and occasionally kick chairs down the stairs. Well, the seventh ghost was the one Colonel Clarence didn't even know was in residence at the manor. Earlier that year, when he was taking photographs of the house and snapshots of his wife and friends. After he had the films printed, he glanced at the first photograph and gasped. Just a picture of the house, but lounging in the doorway was a man, his arms folded across his chest and a puzzled look on his face as he stared at the camera. Well, the colonel had never seen the man before and knew there was nobody there when he snapped the picture of the house. Strange thing is that the apparition was wearing gaiters, white smock, and a cap of the sort worn by farmers about 200 years ago. And certainly 200 years ago, he wouldn't have known what a camera was, so that would explain his puzzled look. Curiously, it wasn't the only picture the ghost appeared in, because the camera seemed to fascinate him. As the colonel flipped through the print, this ghost kept popping up all over the place, standing in the orchard or bending over to look over Miss Claridge's shoulder or leaning on a car in the driveway. In each picture, he's staring at the camera as if thoroughly baffled. Well, psychic researchers from the Paraphysical Laboratory in Downton in Wiltshire spent many hours in the Claridge house or else studying the photographs. They can't explain the uncanny incidents, several of which the investigators themselves have witnessed. But Colonel Claridge, his wife, and their family become rather fond of the ghost. The only one who annoys them in any way is the poltergeist, but as the Claridge family motto says, fear not, but God. And I guess that's an appropriate motto for anybody living in Sanford Dorcas Manor House. Well, there have been many stories of the strange and the unusual. This next one comes from 1949. Miss Georgina Feeks was having a quiet few moments to herself one afternoon in March of 49 in her living room in Bexley, Kent. The children would soon be arriving home from school. She had time enough to finish reading a magazine story. As she sat back into the armchair with the magazine, she felt a tingling sweep over her body, just like an electric shock. She jumped to her feet. Trembling, she looked around her and saw a golden, glistening, ethereal ball-like object hovering a few feet above the living room floor. No bigger than a tennis ball, but as she stared at it in astonishment, it started to grow. And in the center of that ball of light, she saw a face she recognized. It was her cousin, Owen Howison. And apparently he could see her as well. He smiled at her. She heard his voice faintly, but clearly saying, "Tell my mother you've seen me." And then the apparition vanished. Miss Feeks was still standing there, stunned, when her children came home from school. And although she was well known for her occult powers, she never experienced anything quite so startling before. And she wondered why her cousin Owen had appeared to her. She'd hardly known him because his parents had taken him to South Africa 12 years before. And 5 years before the apparition had appeared to Miss Feeks, he had been killed on active duty in Italy. Knowing some of her relatives were more than inclined to laugh at her occult beliefs, Miss Feeks was reluctant to say anything about the matter. Eventually, though, she wrote and told Beatrice Howison, Owen's mother, about the experience. Almost by return of post, she heard from her Aunt Beatrice in Johannesburg, who told her how Owen had died. He had arrived in Italy and been serving with a tank regiment when his tank received a direct hit. Badly wounded, he managed to drive the tank to safety so that the wounded comrade could get medical attention. And then he died. Well, Miss Feeks saw Owen Howison's ghost again, and she wrote to her aunt to tell her the ghost was now somehow more distinct to her and nearer. When she saw the apparition on this occasion, Owen was carrying a single stalk of fragile blue flowers. She'd never seen anything like them in England, and when Spirit told her, she told his mother he got the flowers up Table Mountain, she'd be able to know for certain that she had seen him. And before vanishing again, Owen told his cousin he'd see her again in about 4 months. It was finally revealed to Miss Feeks by her aunt that in 1940, Owen had climbed Table Mountain and brought back in his shirt a single bloom of the blue Africana flower of the sandpiper, species of gladiolus that was protected by law, which actually forbid anybody to pick them. Plants slender and erect, growing up to 2 feet high, and it flowers from June to October. Well, until seeing the blossom held by Owen's ghost, it was later confirmed Miss Feeks didn't even know that particular flower existed. Correspondence in January of 63 with Professor Ian Stevenson, psychic expert at the University of Virginia, Miss Feeks gave more details about her contacts for her cousin's ghost. Well, Owen eventually told her himself, she reported, that his tank was blown up and wanted her to tell his mother he wasn't dead. He also asked Miss Feeks to give his regards to somebody named Helen. Now, it was when she asked the apparition to give her some proof so that his mother would be convinced that he took from his shirt one stalk of the blue Africander, which he showed her. The ghost did this several times and told her to tell his mother. In a later vision, the ghost reminded Miss Feeks she hadn't yet told Helen, and that poor Helen had wept sorrowfully. Miss Feeks had no idea who Helen was till Owen's mother, visiting England in 51, explained that Helen and Owen had been close friends and Helen had been terribly upset by his death. Well, she always saw Owen in daylight, usually on bright sunny days, and his voice, though sounding far off, was always real and alive. Whenever he appeared after that first instance, she never felt any fear, but always she felt that all her energy was being drained from her body. It was because of this she thought her cousin's visits to her are usually quite brief. The important clue in this case is, of course, the blue flower. Miss Feeks had never seen it before, and it grows nowhere else in the world. And she didn't know that Owen had once climbed Table Mountain and picked a flower until she was told about it by her Aunt Beatrice. Well, that does raise some interesting questions. Apparently, something survives after death, and certain people have the ability to see it. I know a friend of mine who is an incredibly accurate psychic has said much the same thing to me. Some part of you survives, whether you want it to be or not. And other people have the ability to see it. Well, there's a story about General George Perea, retired British soldier. He decided to walk from Shanghai across Tibet and China to the Caspian Sea. It was a long walk, further than anybody had ever ventured before, and he was going to go the whole way alone. Setting out from Shanghai in March of 1920, he was soon far within the dark, mysterious depths of Asia. No doubt he was going to see things that no European had ever seen before. One evening, many months after he began his journey, a Tibetan shepherd directed him to the cave of a holy man, assuring him he'd find shelter there for the night as well as a welcome. And the shepherd was totally correct. The Tibetan holy man greeted him in faultless Italian, but with an archaic dialect, which surprised Perea, especially when he learned the holy man had never left the cave since boyhood. And in fact, Perea was the first European he had ever met. So where did he learn Italian? It was from this holy man that Perea first heard about the mountain called Omni Makan, the highest mountain in the world. It lay hundreds of miles further inside Tibet. Well, naturally, the general doubted this because he had seen Mount Everest. But the holy man knew about Everest too, and he was quite adamant that Omni Makan was many thousands of feet higher. Well, they talked long into the night about the mountain, a holy mountain, which was doubly protected by a dedicated tribesman and by a curse. Benny Infidel managed to slip past the Golok warriors who had been guarding the mountain for generations, and the curse of Omni Makin would strike them down. They would die. Well, maybe not immediately, explained the Tibetan, but no man could escape with his life after seeing Omni Makin. No unbeliever, that is. Well, the general was excited by this mystery and knew that Omni Makin, if it existed, was something he couldn't afford to miss. A mountain higher than Everest was too incredible not to try to see it. Where for more than a year, the general wandered about Tibet and China, following slender clues, searching for Omni Makin. The natives he spoke to were either strangely silent on the subject or else told him to stay away. They warned him it was a cursed place, especially for a white man. Only one day his dream came true. From a point several hundred miles away, he saw Omni Makin, or at least the range of mountains. Soaring many thousands of feet into the clouds was the bleak face of a gigantic mountain. In fact, it was so vast it took his breath away. Well, he had traveled most continents. He had seen the Canadian Rockies, climbed the Himalayan peaks, and explored the South American Andes. But none of these mountains filled him with the excitement he felt when he saw Omni Makin. He was certain it was the mightiest mountain he'd ever seen. And immediately he set about returning to England to organize a proper expedition to climb Omni Makin. Well, he was so thrilled by what promised to be the greatest discovery of the century, he forgot all about the holy man's warning. He forgot the curse of Omni Makin, about which so many Tibetans had warned him. Arriving at a village on the Tibetan-Chinese border, he met the famous American explorer, Joseph Rock, and he told Rock about his discovery. The American didn't believe him. However, the more they discussed the subject, the more convinced that Rock became that the general had found something very unusual. Next morning, the general set off on his journey back to the coast. A few hours after crossing into China from Tibet with a caravan train of merchants, he died. The general fell off his horse, clutched his heart with both hands, spun around, stared back at Tibet, and groaned in agony, collapsed, and died. Did the curse of Omni Makin kill him? The Tibetans and Chinese all thought so, and the merchants, knowing that the general claimed to have seen the mountain, refused to touch his body. He simply left him lying in the sand and reported his death to an English missionary later that day who arranged to bury him. Everybody who knew the English soldier was surprised by his death from heart failure because he'd always been a fit and healthy man. And when he set out on his walking expedition, he'd been only in his late 40s. And of course, nobody in their right mind believed that a curse had killed him. Then during the Second World War, several Allied and American pilots reported almost crashing into a mysterious mountain on the Chinese border of Tibet. And they were all amazed by the experience as their altimeters recorded heights of more than 30,000 feet. And that was almost 1,000 feet higher than Everest. A few years after the war, an American journalist, intrigued by the rumors and by the story of the general and his death, set off to reach Omni Makin and found it. There were three white men in the party. One of them was killed by a landslide a few days after discovering Omni Makin. The second died from typhoid fever in Peking, and the journalist was drowned several months later. And unfortunately, the scientific instruments for recording the mountain's height had been damaged by the rough handling from the native bearers and the months of being jogged about on horseback over trackless countryside. Did the curse of Omni Makin kill these three as well? Certainly no white man had ever glimpsed this mountain and lived for any length of time afterwards. But it would be interesting to get a good look at a mountain higher than Everest. Well, let's go to Swansea. The Howell family had been living in the house on Rutter Street in Swansea for 3 days when it started. On the night of January 19, 1965, David Howell was startled from his sleep. He could hear his wife, Marcia, groaning beside him. Her voice is growing weaker and weaker. Well, his alarm changed to fear because in the blackness of the bedroom, something is trying to smother him as well. Threw up his arms, waved his fist in the air, but there was nothing there, but something he felt was weighing down heavily on his face, crushing the breath from his body and blocking his mouth and nostrils. Choking and gasping, he made one great effort to roll from the trap and slid onto the floor. Hurled himself across the room, switched on the lights, swung around, and there was nobody but his wife, who was obviously choking to death. The very air in the room was thick and heavy, and felt his senses reeling, almost as if they were being gassed. So he staggered across to the window and smashed out the glass. He couldn't get it open. And then the heaviness started leaving the room reluctantly because it kept trying to come back in. David could feel waves of it ebbing away and then flowing back again. Once the fresh air had filled the room, all that was left was an odor like dead fish. After reviving his wife and checking in the children were all safe, he started to investigate the house for a gas leak. But in the hallway on the way to the kitchen, he stopped, as he remembered that none of the houses in that part of Rota Street had gas connected to them. Everything was electric. Though both the Howells were alarmed at their experience, they were inclined to put it down as some sort of nightmare. But they were worried in case it happened again. But their fear seemed groundless because the days and weeks slipped past and nothing out of the ordinary happened. At least nothing happened until one evening in November, almost 10 months later. The Howells in the living room, and to her horror, she suddenly saw a medicine bottle rise off the mantelpiece and fly through the air towards her. She fled the room, closed the door, and heard the bottle smash against the door she just shut. Scared out of her wits, she ran to the front door, where she met her husband just returning from work. He went to investigate, and the living room looked like it had been hit by a tornado. Every piece of furniture in the place had been turned upside down and scattered around the room. Another strange incident happened on December 1st when Ms. Howell's grandmother was sitting in the front room of the house holding the baby. A loud crashing noise was heard coming from another room. Ms. Howell, though frightened, ran to the door of the living room and tried to open it to get inside, but to her amazement, it was tightly shut. She couldn't open it, even though there was no lock on the door. Although upset by this, she had to leave the house to fetch her daughter Beverly from a nursery school. On returning home, she found she was able to get into the living room finally, but what she saw the doctor. Once again, all the furniture had been thrown about. A settee was upturned, the television set thrown to the floor, and chairs had been heaped on top of the TV. Going up to her own bedroom, she discovered that frightening presence had been at work there, too. Her bed had been turned upside down and thrown on top of the baby's crib. Well, the grandmother left the house with the other children, and the back door was locked, so there was no way to get inside the house other than past her. She waited for David to come home. When he arrived, they both heard another crashing sound from inside the house. When they investigated, they found an unconnected gas stove in the kitchen lying on its side. Well, after that, the Howells left the house to stay with relatives and eventually moved out permanently. Psychic investigators were called in but found no reasonable explanation to account for the strange incidents that turned the once happy house into a house of fear. Well, you know, sometimes we walk into situations that are absolutely baffling. The same thing happened to a lady named Jane Frost. One morning in January of 1951, she took an electric stove to be repaired at a local shop in the small Sussex town where she lived. Before she knew it, she was involved in one of the most curious of psychic incidents, though she didn't fully realize anything was odd until later. You see, she was a regular customer at the repair shop, so she was quite irritated when she saw old Mr. Brown instead of one of the other men coming down the stairs from the back of the shop. He was dressed in his usual clothes, an old-fashioned pork pie hat and a faded, shiny navy blue suit. He'd been wearing that same suit since long as she could remember. But she was annoyed on this particular day because she was in a hurry. She knew the old man dithered about when serving customers, as he liked to stand around having a friendly chat. Miss Frost had been hoping that the son of the old man's business partner, who were both younger and more competent, would deal with her. Now, there were a few other customers in the shop at the time, and the old man's partner was busy serving them. Short flight of stairs down which she saw the old man approach came from a room behind the shop counter. Just as old Mr. Brown was making his slow way down the steps to serve her, she heaved a sigh of relief because when the old man was about halfway down, his son came from the room and brushed past his father without even looking at him. Now, though Miss Frost was certainly happy to be served by the son, she couldn't help feeling sorry for the old man because of the rude way in which his son had just pushed past him. Glancing toward the old man to see how the rudeness of the younger man had affected him, she saw him falter for a second on the stairs, and then he turned and went back up the stairs into that back room. Later that day, Miss Frost told her sister Ruth that she'd left the electric stove to be repaired and made the comment that, "I thought I was going to be served by the old man. You know what he's like. Never knows when to stop talking." Luckily, the young son came out instead. And her sister stared at her. "You saying you saw the old man?" And Jane nodded. Then Ruth said, "I thought you knew. Old Mr. Brown died last week." Well, Ruth explained she learned of the old man's death from his daughter-in-law, whom she'd met in the shop. Now, Jane's amazement was so genuine, nobody doubted what she had seen. He didn't look the least bit like a ghost, but as solid-looking as anyone else in the shop. But at that time, the apparition, or whatever it was, could have been no more than 4 yards away from her. She certainly had eyesight good enough to see him. She was closely questioned by psychic researchers about her experience, but she insisted she definitely saw the old man and pointed out it was daylight. And the light was so good, it couldn't have been a trick of the light. She further claimed that she wasn't all that conscious seeing a ghost, but she didn't doubt it was the old man himself, because she didn't know until later he was dead. And further investigation also confirmed this was the first time she'd ever seen a ghost, and neither Jane or her sister were at all interested in the supernatural. So you have to ask yourself, why was she the only person in the shop to see the old man's ghost? Now, psychic experts say this is by no means unusual. Is there many recorded cases of one or two people in the company of others seeing a ghost and nobody else did? And the proof lies in the fact that she went to the shop not knowing the old man was dead. So when she saw him, she wasn't all aware of something phenomenal. Well, you know, there's some places on the planet that seem to be frozen in time. And one of those places is in the mountains not far from the bustling industrial Italian city of Fogliano. I'm talking about the village of Cencelli. It's not a big village. It's composed of a few lines of stone-built peasant cottages. In fact, it's changed only a little since the past 2,000 years. But for most of that time, it's been called the Village of Miracles, and people who live there have been known as the saintly people. For the 12 Cencelli families who live there can cure even the most painful attacks of rheumatism. Now, it was only a few years after the end of the Second World War that Cencelli became even more widely known. Before that, it was only the peasants in the surrounding district that knew about the legend and about the cures the Cencellis had made. Today, that village's reputation's spread to many places. The peasants could become rich and their village could become a shrine, but as always, they deny there's anything supernatural about their powers. All they can do is speak about the thousands of people who found a cure at the hands of a Kanseli and tell how it all started. Stories have even been recorded in ancient scrolls in the libraries of the Vatican, and it tells how St. Peter visited Kanseli to preach to the peasants. When he arrived there, he was almost crippled with rheumatism, and the Kanseli families nursed him until he was better. From that day onward, 12 Kanseli men have had the knowledge to heal anybody suffering from rheumatic ailments. But there's only about a dozen families there, all of whom can trace their ancestors back to the original families in the Village of Miracles. And this tracing has been done through the parish registers, so it's fairly accurate. When St. Peter was lying ill, each family appointed one male member to take turns in nursing him. Today, there's one healer in each family who's secretly given the cure by his father. Well, the secret of the cure has never been recorded, and all that observers have noticed is that the Kanseli leader makes the sign of the cross, mutters a prayer in the local language, and touches the alien person in a certain secret way. Strangely enough, in spite of all this, the Kanselis are still mostly illiterate people who've never tried to sell their cure in secret. Any money that does come to them from grateful patients is handed immediately to the local church. The only way they attempt to explain their gift is that it comes to them through their faith, because they're just farmers, and frankly, poor farmers at that. Whenever somebody comes to the Village of Miracles to be healed, the Kanselis never hesitate to leave their work, no matter how important that job may be, because to them, curing the sick is the most important thing in the world. Well, Kanseli's fame started to spread during the Second World War when an American colonel was suddenly crippled with rheumatism during a campaign in the mountains. One of the Italian resistance fighters told him about the Kanselis and brought one of them, a shepherd, to see the colonel. Well, the colonel was naturally skeptical about the whole thing, but as the Kanseli was on the point of leaving again, a spasm of pain racked the colonel's body. The Kanseli shepherd stepped forward and worked his magic. After that, the news was soon spread through Italy by the American forces, and the strange gift that had been regarded for centuries as local superstition was suddenly in demand. The Kanselis have so far refused to leave Italy to take their cure to other countries, though people are free to come to them. And if they're asked to visit somebody in Italy, they always walk, just as one 65-year-old healer did, walking all the way to Brindisi in southern Italy to treat a wealthy industrialist. Took the old farmer many weeks to make the trip, but when he arrived at the house, he performed his cure. Then he left the house immediately and started a long walk back to Kanseli. Now, not all the Kanseli men have the gift, and none of the women know the secret. Healers select young boys in the family to follow in their footsteps and secretly teach them how to cure. Sometimes the boys are actually healing when they're as young as 10 years old. Well, in spite of all the successes and apparent miracles, the Kanselis have no wish to see their village become a gathering place for pilgrims, as they claim this will bring other people who would try to capitalize on the richest gift any man could wish to have. The knowledge they have the power to heal is apparently the only word the Kanselis want. And they've known this for over 2,000 years. Well, sometimes events happen that are so unbelievable that it seems impossible. One chilly afternoon in September of 1950, a small group of government officials, a doctor, and a photographer made their way along the path that wound between the tombstones in Camerino Cemetery in Italy. At the end of the path, a group of grave diggers waited for them, leaning idly on their shovels and pickaxes, frankly wondering what was going on. Well, the two groups of men met beside one of the faded, weathered tombstones in an overgrown corner of the cemetery. Brushing the weeds aside and scraping moss from the stone, the doctor read the details inscribed on the the tombstone, is the grave of a 38-year-old woman, Rosa Spadoni, who died on September 4th, 1939. Looking back at the government officials, the doctor nodded and said, "This is it." Well, at the signal from the government officials, the workmen moved in and started to dig their way down to recover an 11-year-old coffin. They still didn't know why they were doing it. They just knew what they were doing. Well, nobody was totally sure what they were doing. It might have all been a hoax or a wild goose chase. Or it might have been the final horrifying episode in one of the most gruesome stories ever told. As a result of an experiment of the psychic powers by Dr. Giuseppe Stoppolino at the Camerino University earlier that year, he'd been conducting a series of experiments with a well-known Italian medium, Mario Bocca. The first few days, though, nothing had happened to convince Dr. Stoppolino that Bocca could really communicate with the dead. There'd been too many flaws in the seances to intrigue his logical mind. And then one day, when he was just about to drop the investigation, something strange happened. Bocca started to get up from his chair, but then he passed out. Stoppolino and his assistant rushed forward to revive him, but before they did, Bocca's eyes rolled open. Now, it was clear that he couldn't see him. There was a strange glaze across his eyes, and beads of sweat standing out on his brow made it clear he'd been seized by some frightful power. At first, Stoppolino was puzzled. There had been no evidence of epilepsy in Bocca's medical history, and neither had the man had any access to drugs. It was then that Bocca's lips parted slightly and a voice spoke. It wasn't Bocca's naturally deep masculine voice with its Sicilian accent. It was a woman's voice, a terrified young woman asking for help. She said her name was Rosa Minicelli, and that she'd been buried alive in her coffin, and she begged the laboratory team to have her body exhumed from Camerino Cemetery. Under questioning, Rosa told Stoppolino she died in September 1939 from her puerperal infection and heart failure, and she'd been buried. But she hadn't really died. She'd gone into a coma. Such a deep coma, the doctors had declared her dead. Next thing she remembered, waking up in the coffin, hearing the distant voice of the priest and the dirt thudding down on the top of the coffin. Well, as the voice started to die away, its last plea to Stoppolino was to make arrangements for her body to be exhumed so the truth might be revealed and a proper burial arranged. Bocca recovered about a half hour later, and when Stoppolino played back a tape recording of the spirit message, the medium was completely baffled. Well, Stoppolino and his assistant searched through the parish records to find when Rosa Minicelli had died, where her grave was. But there was no record of any Rosa Minicelli having been buried in Camerino. This is Stoppolino was about to give up the whole thing as a hoax. He got an astonishing piece of news. A student at the university had an aunt whose name had been Rosa Minicelli. She'd been buried in the cemetery September 1939, but the name on her tomb was her married name, Rosa Spadoni. Well, further research revealed that Rosa Spadoni had died at the time and of the causes the spirit voice had stated through Mario Bocca. A bleak case for an exhumation was built up and sent to the public health office, and permission was finally, though reluctantly, granted to recover the body. Well, it was almost twilight before the workmen finally reached the almost completely decomposed coffin. Shining a powerful lamp into the grave, Giuseppe Stoppolino jumped down and pried off the rotting wooden lid. And he reeled back in horror at the sight that confronted him. There's every evidence to show that Rosa Minicelli Spadoni had indeed been buried alive. Nothing more than a skeleton, but she died the most horrible death imaginable. Her spine had been arched in an attempt to break through the coffin lid, and Apparently, in her first fit of frenzy at the ghoulish predicament, she'd wrenched out her hair in frustrated despair and fear. Then she tried to choke herself by pushing one hand as far down her throat as she could. Slender clues the doctors who carried out an autopsy could find all indicated she died slowly from suffocation, probably after the longest and loneliest 24 hours of her life. What do you do when you're buried alive? Well, you know, I've said before that time is not always a linear event. Sometimes some of us can either look across or step across time. One example of this came from 1942. It was a warm July afternoon. Flying Officer John Devlin, Royal Air Force, was on duty in the control tower at Montrose Air Base in Scotland. That was a fairly easy job that particular day, as none of the planes from Montrose were in the air, and none were scheduled to take off until that evening when a night raid over German lines was ordered. So until then, there wasn't much for Devlin to do. And the red warning telephone on his desk buzzed. Snatching it up, he was told an unidentified aircraft was heading directly toward the airbase. It had been picked up on radar as it suddenly appeared flying in from the North Sea. While getting a bearing from the coastal defense station, Devlin and his assistant scanned the sky for the approaching plane. And from the southeast, they heard the distant drone of an engine. And coming toward the airbase, flying at about 1,000 feet, was a biplane that swooped out through a bank of heavy thunderclouds. Now, Devlin was a recognized authority in airplanes, especially fighters and bombers, but to his surprise, he couldn't identify that one. Neither could any of his assistants. It was a small, light blue biplane with a front radial engine. The lower main plane was smaller than the upper one and staggered well back, and the air screw boss gleamed a bright red. Even the throbbing of the engine was unfamiliar, and he thought he knew all the sounds of all the engines. That evening, Devlin discussed the mystery aircraft in the mess, and fellow officers laughed at him, saying he'd eaten too well at lunch. He must have dreamed up the whole business. Well, the matter might have been forgotten after that, but a few days later, when Devlin was again on duty at the control tower with two other assistants, they spotted that same biplane following that same course and vanishing again. This time, Devlin and his staff kept the matter to themselves. At least Devlin did, until a few days later when he heard a civilian employee, a local man, talking about the base in the old days. Now, Sandy was his name. He was a local man who had been saying that the aerodrome had been a training school during the First World War. And Devlin asked what sort of aircraft had been used then. Well, Sandy replied more than one type. There were SE-5s, DH-9s, Bristol Bulldog fighters, except with pups and camels. Devlin had a thought, and he said, well, what was the camel like? Well, Sandy said it was a small biplane with a wing at the bottom set back from the top wing, and the engine, a radio, made an unusual throbbing noise. Well, after that, an amazed and thoughtful Devlin went back to his hut. Of course, it might have been a coincidence, he thought, but remembering the way in which that plane had vanished, he wondered if he'd been seeing a ghost plane. Now, that whole supposition seemed impossible. Incredible, even. But Sandy's description matched exactly that mystery biplane. A few days later, he mentioned the incident to Sandy, and to his surprise, the old Scotsman just smiled and nodded his head. Devlin said, you mean it was a ghost plane, but it looked as real as our own? Well, he was even more amazed by something else, Sandy told him. A few months earlier, a shepherd named Jack McCleary had been searching for lost sheep up in the hills. Now, this shepherd knew the mountains like the back of his hand, but on that day, he found himself wandering miles from his home in a place far too rugged and wild for sheep to have strayed. Well, as he tried to find his way back to familiar territory, he came to a huge gash in the rocks, and his dog began to whimper and refused to pass the place. Well, curiosity got the better of him, and Jack McCleary investigated. And there in the rocks, he found a human skull. And further on, it was something else, the wreckage of a small biplane. Later, when Devlin had time to investigate for himself, he calculated that there was a crash there. The biplane must have flown directly over the Montrone airfield, exactly on the same route the biplane he had seen had flown. Who was the pilot? We'll never know. Well, you know, it's sad when you dream. If you dream, you die in the dream, you die. Well, this next story is about a man who did that. Mary Gledhill's dream that night in March of 1929 was about an express train racing through the darkness. That wasn't a remarkable dream for her experience, because her husband Jack was a train engineer. And she saw him in the dream, too, standing on the footplate, keeping an alert eye on the signals as he built up the speed in the locomotive. He was aiming to set another record run between London and Scotland. Yeah, there was nothing out of the ordinary happening for most of the trip, at least in Mary's dream. Because everything is running smoothly. All the signals are in the right position to give the Night Express a clear run through without stopping. And suddenly, though, it all changed. As the engine built up to maximum speed to dash through a city station, the signal suddenly swung from the all clear to the danger. Her dream changed to a nightmare. She saw Jack swiftly try everything he'd learned in his many years as an engineer to bring that speeding train to a halt. But unfortunately, with a speeding train, nothing could stop it. It was like some super powerful runaway monster. There was the vicious rending of metal and clouds of hissing and bellowing steam and unearthly crash, followed by a moment's silence. And before the wreckage could be seen through the smoke and flying debris, Mary jumped out of the bed screaming to find her husband lying in bed beside her. And she woke Jack up and told him about it. Next morning, she was still unable to forget the horror she'd witnessed, although Jack tried to smooth away her fears by explaining it was only a dream. But Mary was certain it was something more, that it had been a premonition of disaster. She begged Jack to stay at home that day. Well, he said that was out of the question. He had to go back to his job. The rest of that day, Mary was so on edge, she didn't dare leave the house. She couldn't do a thing except sit in her armchair and wait for Jack to come home. Hours passed. The daylight faded, and then the twilight thickened. Soon it was nighttime, and Jack was more than 3 hours late. Finally, she heard a man's footsteps walking down the quiet street toward the house. Well, it was Jack. His train had been delayed by a derailment near Carlisle. He comforted her by saying that that had been all her dream and warned her about. And although she pretended to accept that, she wasn't convinced. Jack, though, was only too eager she should forget her nightmare, as he was prepared to do. The weeks went past, and nothing happened until one evening as his train was running into Dorchester. Suddenly, he felt the cold sweat of fear breaking out all over him for no reason at all. Careful not to say anything to his fireman, he controlled the faintness that made him tremble all over. But the train swept on through the night without anything happening. A few days later, he had a similar experience to the nightmare Mary had dreamed, but he refused to believe it was anything more than his imagination. But in his dream, as he later said, the scene of the crash was just outside Dorchester, exactly on the spot where he had felt uncannily faint a few days before. Then he had another dream about that same stretch of territory and about a train in which he was the engineer. Seemed to be nothing unusual about the dream trip. All signals were set to give him a clear run when suddenly, as if out of nowhere, he saw another railway man appear in the track right in front of his locomotive. Far too late for him to do anything about it, and as the train thundered on some distance before the brakes could stop it, he knew he had to have hit the man. Brought to a halt, Jack jumped down and ran back along the line and saw, to his horror, the dead railway man lying on the track was himself. This dream with slight variations came in to torment him. Five more nights. Inevitably, Jack began to believe the dreams were some kind of omen and discussed them with several people. But in September of that year, not having had his strange dream for some time, he certainly wasn't thinking of that dream when he was once more driving a train scheduled to stop in Doncaster. All the way from London, the engine was giving trouble, not pulling as it should have. When he stopped in Doncaster Station, he reported this, and arrangements were made to have the locomotive uncoupled and driven to the repair sheds there and a fresh engine hitched on for the remainder of the journey. Jack was down on the tracks watching a man uncouple his train when it happened. There was no warning vibration, no sound. A freight train struck him, knocking him from the track. When his friends got to him, he was unconscious. Shortly after that, he died. Well, there are many stories of odd things that have made the rounds. This one comes from October of 1890. It was late one cold evening as the winter mist was swirling around the lonely farmhouse in the Mendip Hills in Somerset. Bernard Collins glanced out the window and saw a frail figure staggering across the rutted cart track. There was an old woman wrapped in a shawl, cowering against the cold, damp weather. Somebody of her age was doing wandering about in such a place in that weather and at such a late hour puzzled Bernard, so he sent his 9-year-old son Trevor running out into the twilight to invite the old woman to the shelter of the house. Making the old woman comfortable, they provided her with food and hot tea in front of the good fire. The boy took off the woman's wet boots and placed them in front of the fire to dry. Gradually, they heard her story. She told them she'd been fired from her domestic job because she was too old and was making her way to live with her son and his wife. But since she didn't have any money, she had to walk all the way. Well, Bernard Collins insisted as the weather was so bad, she'd stay the night at his cottage. And in the morning, he took her the rest of the way to her son's home in his horse and cart. Well, a year later, the Collins had almost forgotten the incident until one day Bernard was driving to the market in a nearby town. Before he left in his horse and cart, his wife rather anxiously said she fancied there was a storm brewing. His business at the market took longer than he thought, and so by the time he was ready to drive back home, it was already dark, and he knew his wife would worry if he was late. We decided to go via the dangerous short route through the hills because it would save him a lot of time, even though that usual road, a longer route, was safer. The short route was a rough, hard road. And it was an old rickety bridge he had to cross. Just as he left town, the storm his wife had predicted broke in all its violence. The thunder rolled, lightning flashed, and the rain came down. A few miles out of town, he recognized that same old woman he'd seen a year ago standing huddled in her shawl by the roadside. Surprised to see her, Bernard told her to get into the cart. He said, "You certainly picked the worst weather for your little jaunts." She said, "I knew you were in town. I was waiting for you." When he got to the junction, he drove into the road and would take him home the short route. And the old woman suddenly began, you can't take it. Take the longer route. Well, he did and arrived safely. Found out later the old woman was dead long before he picked her up on the side of the road. She came back to repay his kindness. Until tomorrow, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening.